Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you very much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Mr. Host at 7 o'clock. Right now, on this day, the 11th day of the 11th month, back in 1930, Albert Einstein would receive a patent for the Einstein refrigerator. Is there anything this man didn't invent? In 1954, The Two Towers would be published in London. For those who don't know, that is the second volume of the Lord of the Rings book. Yes, it is that old. 1957 on this day, Jerry Lewis would give us Great Balls of Fire that would go on to make a million, or sell a million copies, rather, in the first 10 days. 1968, the Maldives would gain independence. 1975, Angola would gain independence from Portugal. 1987, Irises by Vincent van Gogh would go off, or would sell on auction for $53.6 million. 1994, on this day, Bill Gates would buy Da Vinci's Codex, Leonardo da Vinci's Codex, that is the most expensive manuscript sold to date that we know of, for $30.8 million. 2017, on this day, Alibaba would decide they wanted to make some money as well. They would have their largest single day of sales at $25.3 billion. A year later, they'd do it again on the exact same day, notching up $30.8 billion on that particular day, with $1 billion of that coming in 85 seconds. That must be a world record somewhere. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I'm your host, Jimmy Muyaha, and on the show today, we take a look at the results from Raubex. We take a look at results from Omnia. We take a look at results from Vodacom, if we get around to that. But we're also going to go down a bit of a rabbit hole. We're going to take a look at what the latest developments are in the MTI scandal. Those that don't remember that were clearly not the victims of the MTI scandal, but those that were burnt by MTI know that very, very well. We're going to see what's happening there, because it looks as though some interesting information has come to light and we might have new information to look at. And then, because it's Monday, we're going to take a look at a personal finance segment on a Monday. We're going to be looking at structured products and structured portfolios. We're going to understand those a little bit better and see how they fit into your investment landscape.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As you know, it wouldn't be much of a market update if we didn't actually update the markets. I'm joined on the line by portfolio manager at Rand Swiss, Viv Govender, to take a look at the market movements throughout the day and see if we can make sense of the day that was. Good evening, Viv. Lovely to speak to you again. Markets today, I can't make heads or tails of what's going on. We saw the US election result come through. We saw that sentiment kind of filter through into the markets. The dollar gained strength. We kind of got past that. But we've started off this week and nothing seems to make sense.
I think it does. If you think of it as, like, you know, what's the drivers out there? And the big driver for our market today was the resource sector down, you know, quite substantially. And the reason for that is quite simple. If you look globally, the number one demander of commodities is China. You know, it's not only the largest or second largest economy in the world, but in terms of its GDP, it actually consumes a great deal more commodities than you would think based on its GDP. And the stimulus package that they had come out recently focused on things that the market did not really like. You know, basically trying to rescue their local governments as opposed to stimulating the overall economy. And that's why you see, for instance, you know, the Hang Seng and the pressure, you know, down about 1.5% today. And you see Chinese, you know, you see commodity markets, like I said, the resource sector down, you know, quite substantially today. That's the overall reason that we are seeing our overall market as negative as it is at the moment.
Viv, when we look at the commodity space, that would obviously be driving some of the resource counters. We see platinum and palladium pricing softer, but gold pricing as well, more than 2.5% down on the day's trade. Obviously, we saw an initial kind of knee-jerk reaction from 27.50 down to 26.50 when Donald Trump won that election result and became the president-elect of the United States. What's kind of happening here? Are we seeing a risk-off sentiment come into the market? What's driving this? Obviously, the correlation to the dollar might have something to do with it.
I think it's more of a risk-on sentiment because, I mean, why do you want to be holding some yellow metal when you can buy, like, Tesla, which is up massively in the last couple of days, or, you know, Bitcoin, as the other example I would give. And I always think that people underestimate the substitution effect of Bitcoin versus gold. Because think of it, you have Bitcoin and you have gold for the similar kind of reasons that the world's falling apart and you want the thing that's basically not going to be affected by inflation. If you look at the price of Bitcoin over the last 5 days, it's up like 12%. And that obviously would indicate that people are going towards it. And I think that's probably one of the reasons we are seeing this kind of pressure on gold as well. But likewise, I mean, if you look at, like I mentioned, if you look at the FAANG prices, the FAANG stocks over the last couple of days, especially things like I said, Tesla, Tesla's share price is up another 10% today. And basically, the last 5 days, this thing is up 42%. If people ever ask you what's one of the best investments ever made, it might be the Elon Musk purchase of Twitter. Because yes, he may have lost, I think, $20 billion on that, but he's probably made double that back on the valuation increases in SpaceX and Tesla in the last week. And I think also if you look at, for instance, some of the other big US companies out there, you'd find like, for instance, even Amazon up 5% over the last week or so. Even though it might not be earning as much as Tesla, but it's still seeing all these like these tech companies doing really well. In that scenario, why do you want to go buy some yellow metal that's going to sit in the vault and protect yourself from, inflation or whatever?
Viv, the contrarian view on that is because the fact that we are going to go into a recession at some point. There's a couple of indications that point towards that. There's other indications that point to the fact that we're not even going to get close to that. What are your views on where we stand at the moment? We've kind of seen that the US has pretty much, especially from a Fed perspective, nailed it on bringing inflation down, managing interest rates, managing that narrative, and doing their job there. Do you think we have the recession conversation still on the table?
Oh, yeah, most certainly. I mean, you look at the non-farm payroll numbers that came out recently. They were very, very, shocking.
The 12,000.
12,000 versus basically 10 times as much expected. And so there's, but obviously that was also, to a certain extent, there were natural disasters and there were like, strikes affecting it possibly. So there's indicators that we are going to be seeing, pressure on the US. But that being said, I mean, if you look at Donald Trump's, objectives, without looking at some of the culture war stuff, just the economic stuff. Yes, he's talking about tariffs. He's also talking about reducing regulation. He's also talking about, easing up on things like energy production, with producing oil from the ground. Nuclear is a big thing with him as well. I mean, these are a lot of things that could very easily give the US a bit of a jump start over the next, say, 3, 4 years. And I think it might be a temporary, recession if we are actually heading to that pathway already. But these things that he's saying in that his plans going forward, excluding the tariff stuff, which I might say is probably negative for all of the world. But I think you could be easily seeing, an extra jump up in the US growth rates over the next few years if you can basically remove onerous regulation, if you can remove, some of the barriers to things like energy production. The US could be doing really well, especially if you consider the fact that, some of the new technologies coming out, the space technology, which we one of the reasons Elon Musk got involved in with Donald Trump was to get the space stuff, running up faster. You could look at the AI stuff as well. Donald Trump is more likely than Biden to be more liberal on his AI policy. So I think you could be seeing this kind of industrial action, at least the short term or to medium term, boosting economic growth in the US.
Speaking of the US, Viv, I'm just having a quick squiz at the latest polling numbers. The Republicans have taken the presidency, they've taken the Senate, and it looks like they are dangerously close to taking the House of Representatives. If that does pan out and that does play out that way, how much more does that strengthen the case that you just laid forward about the fact that people like Elon Musk would be looking forward to deregulation in certain areas?
I don't even think they need the House for that, quite frankly.
Hmm.
The House basically, if you're looking at things like, for instance, budgets, you're looking at things like creating laws, it's fine, you're the House. But if you want to get somebody in charge of the EPA, you want to get somebody in charge of the FDA, you do not need the House, you only need the Senate. And they already have 53 Senate votes. And if you look at the fact that they would have the presidency, which gives them that extra tiebreaker vote, so effectively, they have a 4-vote margin. In order to get things through. So the Biden administration was kind of hamstrung, which they only had like a 2-vote margin. And if two of the senators basically turned against them, they couldn't do anything. And that was one of the reasons that they couldn't, push as much as they wanted to on basically infrastructure, et cetera. I think it was Mnuchin and some other one, I can't remember the other senator's name, but there's two senators that basically held a lot of the stuff up. the Republicans have, in effect, twice as much, need four people to step up and basically stop that. So I think that is the one advantage they have. Yes, they will need the House if they want to basically pass like laws and so on. And like you said, I mean, I think the latest odds are something like about an 80% chance that they are going to win the House as well. And you know, there's a few there that basically 216 seats at the moment. They need 218, and I think they are basically they've got. As we've got Alaska, they've got one in California, they've got one in Arizona where they are leading by about 1% or so. And if they can get like two more of those seats through, they will basically have the House as well, though by a smaller margin, which would make them much more vulnerable to pressure from one or two members there.
Viv, when we look at all these macro factors and the dynamics at play, the rand kind of sits in a weird space as an emerging market currency. And I want to look at just today. Today's been a day of weakness for the rand. Obviously, with what's happened on the commodity side, we can expect that we'd see softer prices on the equity side of it. But the rand losing ground against all of the majors, right down to the Australian dollar.
Yeah, look, I mean, we obviously are seeing a bit of pressure coming through from Africa at the moment. I think people are looking at what's happening in China and the fact that we obviously are, under a bit of pressure with regards to some of our exports to China. That's why one of the reasons we're seeing this commodity market as under pressure as it is. Also, we're looking at our own local economy. Local economic figures are, important. And I think the market is obviously wanting to see just how well we are basically getting out of our weak numbers, that we've been historically experiencing. We're also going to have some mining production figures out this week as well that might be, important in terms of just our ability to supply stuff as just the demand out in the global market. So there's a couple of factors out there. But the rand has been very volatile. I mean, a couple of days ago, we were sitting in the 1720s, now in the 1790s. I think the market really doesn't know where it's going at the moment. That's why you're seeing this kind of volatility. And I wouldn't say for certain that there's a trend that the market's definitely certain of the rand's weakening or the rand's strengthening at the moment.
There's still lots up in the air. We're hopefully going to have some form of clarity, or at least some easing of the pressure that's out there. But for now, we'll leave it at that. Viv, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Always lovely speaking to you. Viv Governor, Portfolio Manager at Rand Swiss, on the market movements throughout the day and what could potentially be driving some of the sentiment.
The Property Pod. Pod.
We're back looking at the residential property market on the Property Pod this week. We zone into residential property as an investment. According to recent research by Lightstone, residential property may be losing its investment appeal. Hayley Ivans Downs, Managing Executive for Real Estate at Lightstone, is on the latest episode to share more insights.
The Property Pod. Pod.
Pod. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
I'm sure the three letters MTI put next to each other are etched in many South Africans' memories. And we got some results earlier, or some news rather, earlier in the year that the founder or the CEO, the mastermind behind the MTI scandal, a gentleman by the name of Johan Steinberg, was found in Brazil having passed away from a pulmonary embolism. Now, by all accounts, that sounds like a case closed. Apparently it's not, and we're going to go down this rabbit hole. It might take us a bit more than one episode of our show to go down the rabbit hole, but it's in the interest of those that were invested in MTI to know if there is a slim chance that you might recover some of your money. I'm joined on the line by Stephen Tim, journalist and researcher, who's been keeping a very close eye on this MTI story and these developments, to take a look at what's going on here. Good evening, Stephen. Lovely to speak to you. Didn't we close this off earlier in the year? Isn't this a cut and dry case? What's going on?
Well, no one knew what exactly he was doing over there in Brazil. So, I was, I thought, I lived there in 2014 and 15, and I speak Portuguese. Why the heck? And I'm a journalist, and I've written about a fraudster before. Why the heck not go over there and check out things? Because that's the real test. You go there, check out a cemetery or the grave, or,
Mm. And that's quite interesting, right? So it's quite, I'm all for a good conspiracy and all of that, but conspiracies are very different from a factual investigation that has uncovered which is what you've done, right?
I'm not a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah, so you've gone through the effort of finding out some of the facts. And let's get into those, Stephen. I want to get into what you've uncovered from your research and from your investigations, because seriously, this is obviously a serious matter. If we even have a slim chance that the individual who faked his death or is said to have faked his death actually did. What have you uncovered?
Well, you know, he was, while he was in Sao Paulo, he was working as a broker, literally doing exactly what MTI was doing, you know? So there's warning lights going off. This was under investigation by the Brazilian authorities, but that investigation was killed off in August by a judge in São Paulo Federal Court that said, well, look, you know, he's dead now. He has his certificate, and you know, the police went and checked out that he's actually dead. So you know, then you go like, okay, so is this guy actually dead? So I went to Goiânia. Probably no one has ever heard of it. It's a massive growing. Well, it's 3.5-4 million people. It's a thriving city, growing like apartment blocks coming up all over the place. In Brazil's heartland, in the agricultural area in the interior, and I visited a cemetery. I visited the Jardim das Palmeiras, where he's buried, and you know, I came to his grave, and his name is not on the gravesite. So, you know, I had to go back to the cemetery office that gave me the where his grave is. And they said, no, he's in there. And they showed me the registry information that they had on the screen. You know, they showed me turned the screen around, and the official there was, you know, very nice, to show me. So I said, oh, okay, he's there. Like, who are these other people? No, they look like family members of his ex-girlfriend, girlfriend. And well, the second thing is that you know, he being in Brazil, they have a wake, it's a Catholic tradition. You know, the body lies there in a room, and people can visit for the last time. They can see the person, the body, before it gets buried. So that's actually usually the main thing, rather than the funeral. So in Catholic tradition, it's the wake. Well, so the Interpol apparently came there like 2 weeks after the funeral was held, which was on the 24th of the funeral was held on the, he was buried on the 24th of April, died on the 22nd, and 15 days later, Interpol rocks up there, and they said, okay, oh, there's a camera there. Please, in the room where the wake was held, please, can you give us the footage? Except that camera was pointed at the door and not at the slab of the marble slab where his body was lying in the casket. So that threw that thing out the window. So you've got an unmarked grave. You know, the only evidence that someone is buried there, I can hand it to you. There is evidence that the earth has been upturned and stuff. Okay, sure. But where's his name? And then the footage of the wake wasn't. So what I'm saying is there's a lot of those two things. It's just a bunch. It's just the first two questions of a lot of questions, you know. Mm. His attorney was very standoffish. In fact, the guy did not answer any of my emails, and I sent him actual questions, you know. The only time he actually ever answered me was when I phoned from a Brazilian SIM card that I got when I came to the country. And then he said, oh, no, I'm actually I'm out of Goiânia now, but, you know, send me a WhatsApp when you arrive. Send the WhatsApp, no answer. So I had to go to his office. And there again, very standoffish, came out with some clients, looked at me like, you know, who's this dirtbag? Then when he came back a few minutes later, he said, what do you want? And, you know, it's like, dude, I'd sent you the email. It's all in Portuguese. What do you mean, what I want? So this guy didn't want to comment. He said, you know, like this shut open and shut case, you know, John, that's what they call him there. Johan Stenberg, he's dead. He doesn't exist anymore. Like, you know, end of story. So I'm like, okay, well, that's a bit weird. And I couldn't go to the prison. Prison said, like, you know, journalists aren't accepted. It's usual practice. Journalists are not allowed in the cells, even though I knew exactly which cell he was staying in the special, it was in a special unit. Mm. So, you know, and then I've been part, it's like, you know, there's a theory that, you know, I got a tip off from someone that, you know, the farm that he was, look, he was under house arrest when he died. So, you know, another warning, another red flag goes up. Okay. So he wasn't actually, so the only time you can actually, you in house in Brazil, like my sort of less serious crimes, or like where there's less of a threat that you might run away or whatever. So they put an ankle bracelet on you and you're assigned to an address, and the only, you can work, I think, as far as I understand, but the only time you can leave that address is when you've got a medical problem. So of course he started having literally panic attacks is what the first thought it was, or what it was described as. But yes, pulmonary embolism, basically a blood clot on the lungs. And he was a smoker, but you know, the guy was 40. He was closing on 41 years. But so there's sort of questions, like if you're a cynical person like me, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, I'm just a cynic. So I'm like, hey, like, you know, there's all these things, you know, people are just not wanting to speak to you. They say, stop asking these questions, he's dead. So, you know, I mean, you got to think, you know, there's a chance that this guy, he was arrested on a fake ID, on two fake IDs, actually. So, you know, like, just think about it. 6,900 Bitcoins is apparently missing. So back then, December 2020, when he left South Africa, that was worth over close to 2.5 billion rand. So, like, okay, there was multiple figures bandied around, you know, 11 billion or whatever it was. But the figure that's liquidators have now established that is actually missing is almost 2.5 billion. Back then, it's worth now more if you take the Bitcoins and translate it to modern money. So, you know, the guy has money. The guy had a well-connected lawyer. He was on house arrest. I mean, there's a bunch of questions. Like, you got to be living in Mars or something, and not to consider. And our police and the Brazilian police, I mean, how... No, really, I don't know. Like, did they actually consider this properly? I don't know.
Well, we're going to have to keep digging down this rabbit hole, see where it takes us. For those interested out there, 6,900 Bitcoins in today's current market value would be just north of 10.4 billion rand that could be going back to investors if we are able to recover it. The next conversation that you and I are going to have, Stephen, is around the co-conspirators and the other parties that are involved, and see if we can track those people down. But we'll have to leave this one there for the interest of time. Thank you so much, Stephen, for the insights. Please keep us up to date on what it is that you find out, because there are certainly investors out there with a vested interest in this outcome. Stephen Tim, journalist and researcher on the MTI matter, and is Johan Stenberg really dead?
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Among the companies that did report numbers today as well was a company called Vodacom. Our editor at MoneyWeb, Rek Vanika, caught up with the Vodacom CEO, Shamil Yusuf, to take a look at the performance of the telecommunications provider. Let's listen in on how that chat went.
Vodacom is one of the largest mobile operators on the continent and has more than 205 million customers in South Africa, Egypt, Ethiopia, Lesotho, Mozambique, the DRC, Tanzania and Kenya through its subsidiary Safaricom. The group announced results for the 6 months to the end of September today, and it was hit by currency devaluations in Egypt and Ethiopia. Revenue rose 1% to 74 billion rand. The headline earnings declined by 20% to 6.8 billion rand, and the board declared an interim dividend of 2.85 a share. On the line is Shamil Yusup. He is Vodacom CEO. Shamil, thank you so much for your time. The significant devaluations of the currencies of Egypt and Ethiopia really hit your profit line. Are you concerned about this for the long term, or were these once-off events that caused those currencies to devalue?
On the one side, of course, when you're trading in Africa, you have to be ready for currency movements and so on. For us, if we look at the Egypt one, I think 60% devaluation in March. But if you look at the underlying growth of the business, it grew by 75%. So the first lesson is you've got to have the patience to see it through. So your net profit grew 75%. So that we more than offset the devaluation impacts. It's broadly behind us now. At least it seems a lot more stable over the next couple of years. And of course, you can always see the buildup of these things when there's a gap between black market rates and official rates, and that seems to have converged. So a very good business and solid growth going forward. So a big opportunity for us for that asset, especially with a more stable currency, to yield very good growth in the Vodacom stable.
Is it possible to hedge yourself against such movements? Because you pay in dollars for expensive equipment, and you need to recoup that from local currency. So if it continues to devalue, when does it really become a big problem?
Well, it really comes down to the growth of the underlying business. So if your growth of the underlying business offsets it and you're still getting your return on capital, then of course it's worth it. What we also do is we right-size the CapEx budget based on the local currency. So if there's a reduction in the revenues in dollars, then we right-size the CapEx budget according to what we call the capital intensity of that particular country. And then we can just buy less widgets for it. So that's one of the ways that we do it. But also we try and make sure that most of our costs, or as much as we can of the costs, are local currency based. On Ethiopia, though, this is relatively new. So it's about a 2 month ago that we've had a 100% devaluation. We've seen some price adjustments in the market that, of course, is helping. But you do take the day one impact of the devaluation, which is effectively taking all your foreign based costs and revaluing it. And so you take that impact immediately over the next 10 years. You take that, what we call the day one impact immediately. So that during the period caused a lot of noise in the numbers, especially in the earnings line. And that was 1.1 billion impact that came through from that. The revenue lines and so on was more impacted by the Egyptian year over year movements. But the bottom line actually was very, very positive.
In your results documentation, you emphasize the growth in your financial services offerings, which grew by 18% if you strip out the impact of the currency devaluations. And it amounts to 7 billion rand, which is around 11% of your total turnover. What is your most widely used financial service you offer?
So most widely used is person-to-person money transfer. So you walk into an agent in one part of a country and you transfer money to someone else in another part of the country. That's the one part, so that's the most used. Then, of course, it's payments. So you can pay by Paysa, or you can pay by VodaPay, or pay by VodaCash. You can pay your bills for different things. And then, of course, merchants also accept mobile money at the point of sale. And then, of course, things like lending, merchant lending, small business lending, overdrafts, loans. These are all part of our offering, and now recently investments as well.
Have you ever considered getting a banking license?
No, because we're actually a platform. So we bring together the customers and the lenders and the banks into one platform. We have 83 million customers. And the way to think about it, on the one side, you've got the banks and you've got lending institutions and you've got merchants and so on. And then the other side, you've got the consumer. And our platform brings that together. And then, of course, we add data analytics, behavioral analytics and all of that into it to enhance the platform.
Many people are starting to use data bundles or data services exclusively. They don't buy the voice bundles or make traditional voice calls anymore because it's so much cheaper to phone through WhatsApp. How would you describe the migration from traditional voice services to data? Do customers' increased use of data offset the loss in traditional call revenue?
It definitely has an impact on our numbers. And of course, we've seen It's now 19% of our revenue is now coming from voice. And that number's declined over the years, whereas the reverse is that you've seen very strong growth in data. So your data traffic up 34% in South Africa, as an example. Your data revenue up close to 10% in South Africa, but your voice revenue down. So your voice revenue down around about 5%. So you are seeing some of these transitions, as you've been explaining, people moving and using voice over data as opposed to the pure voice part. And then one of the ways you deal with that is to create also offers that are integrated offers that include voice and data together.
That's going to be an interesting development, almost like Telkom, who's lost the fixed line revenue virtually completely. But just lastly, Vodacom wanted to buy a 30 to 40% stake in Massif, the fiber operator owned by Remgro, but the competition tribunal put a stop to it. Was this a surprise to you?
Yeah, look, to be honest, I think it's a travesty. I think given the level of investment that's needed into fiber in South Africa, I think it's a ill-informed decision. And it's more of a travesty for South Africa than it is for Vodacom, from the perspective that South Africa really, really needs that investment into fiber. Only 6 million homes passed today, 17 million homes in the country. This was a 14 billion investment that could have risen to as much as 17 billion with an additional 25 billion in capex that Massive would have spent. The company needs this capital injection. And the logic that's been applied to Vodacom, would have, could have, should have built fiber and so on and so on. Vodacom's got 2.5% of the fiber market today. So it's not like competition laws for me should be, you know, if you had two big fiber players or two big telcos trying to merge, that's the context of where the competition part should have come in. But this was an open access vehicle that would have benefited the entire industry. And yeah, would have been very good. For Vodacom, yes, it would have given us access to a faster growing asset, but the remedies and everything would have made sure that essentially Vodacom would have had the same offering as everybody else in the market.
Shamil, thank you so much for your time. That was Shamil Yusup, the Chief Executive of Vodacom.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As usual on a Monday morning like this, bright and early, we got an update, a SENS update from Raubex Group Limited. They gave us an update on their interim results for the half year ended August 2024. They dropped these numbers before 7:30, and we're going to take a look at them with the company's CEO, Felicia Msiza, to take a look at how the company's been performing and what the road ahead looks like. Good evening, Ms. Msiza. Thanks so much for taking the time. Lovely to catch up with you again. The last time you and I spoke was in May, and we were reflecting on the full year that was the 2024 financial year. How has the new year started off for the team?
Thank you very much, Jimmy, for having us. So we are pleased to have reported a strong set of results for the 6 months, which have ended now at the end of August 2024. We are very proud of these results. And I think I must mention that it's only fitting that during the year that we celebrated our 50th anniversary and still celebrating, our share price actually traded above the 50 rands per share mark. So the cash generated by operations was exceptionally strong during this period. It has been up over 110% compared to the prior year. And we've got a solid order book. You will recall that when we had this call at the end of the financial year, our order book was sitting at comfortable levels of 25.5 billion rands. I'm happy to report that we have maintained the order book at similar levels. Currently, the order book, it declined just marginally to about 24.5 billion rands of work.
That's not a big decline considering how much of the order book is still there. When we look at that order book, Felicia, the last time you and I had a catch up, we spoke about the business's plans to diversify into other regions. And obviously, with everything that's happening at Raubex, you kind of want to have a balance of projects that are on the go, projects that are pipeline, projects that are near completion, because in the infrastructure game, you never really know when a project is going to take off or when it's going to be wrapped up. How is that balance shaping up at the moment, and how's that diversification paying off?
Absolutely spot on. So it was a deliberate intention that we took as management that we need to have a diversified order book. I mean, if you look at the split of our divisions, roads and earthworks, infrastructure division, also we're operating in Western Australia, the construction materials division, and then the mining division. So we've actually spread our risk across the four divisions. But over and above that, what we've done, for example, if you look at the roads and earthworks division, we've got a diversified client risk. And that's very important. So instead of just relying on one client, we have spread our risk. Now we had work, you know, from a provincial government point of view, a bit from SANRAL and from concessionaires and from private clients as well. So we've been deliberate. And if you look at the order book, we've actually now diversified. So a bigger chunk of our order book is sitting in private clients and then followed by other clients. So we're quite happy with that. And this is how we want to continue into the future, having a diversified client base. Obviously, now with some of the awards that we're expecting from all divisions, we might see, you know, just a bit of a change in terms of the makeup of the order book. But this is how you're seeing the order book now going forward into the second half of the year.
Felicia, let's get an update on CapEx. The CapEx figure considerably lower than what it was this time last year. Some of those projects, I'd imagine you have gotten offline, you're happy with that. Where's the CapEx sitting at the moment? What kinds of projects are you looking to continue to build on, or to are you introducing new projects? What's happening there?
So, Jimmy, you recall that in terms of the investment that we have at Bauba, we had a ramp-up phase where we needed to actually invest in CapEx to get the mine at a certain stage. So the ramp-up was over the past 2 years. That's where we've seen the highest CapEx spend. So we actually said that we wanted to reduce the CapEx spend, and we're very happy now for the first half of this reporting period that our CapEx is down. So currently, if you look at the other divisions, roads and earthworks, obviously they are not CapEx hungry. In terms of the mining division, it should be more or less similar to what we have now in the first half. And similarly with the infrastructure division, obviously there's a little bit of CapEx spend in terms of our renewable energy projects that side. So in terms of future CapEx investment, we have the Naboom mine, but we're only anticipating that one to come into play in the next year or so. So there won't be any CapEx investment for Naboom. That will only happen in the financial year 2026 or beyond that.
Mm. Felicia, some of the other numbers that were quite impressive to look at: headline earnings per share up 49.8%, earnings per share up 48.2%, operating profits up 34.7%. As a result, the interim dividend looking quite healthy as well. The business is very clearly in a comfortable position where you can say there's not a lot of pressure on us to continue to reward shareholders, but when we are able to, we're going to do it anyway.
So obviously we have a dividend policy, 3x cover, and we've always, in the history of Robex, we've always paid out our shareholders an interim dividend and also at full year. So now with the intention of actually now building our cash, we're looking at a possible share buyback. As management, we would like to purchase some of Robex shares. And also in terms of looking at our organic growth, we're looking at bolt-on acquisitions, nothing too big, something that would actually complement our current service offering. So in terms of cash spend, those are the areas that we can potentially look at. Obviously, in terms of making sure that we've got sufficient cash for our working capital requirements for all of the four divisions.
Those bolt-on acquisitions, I love when companies go shopping. Any particular kind of area or kind of, whether it's industry, sector, geographical location, any more insights you can share about what would be appealing to Raubex at this stage?
So obviously, we're looking at the South Africa side and also Western Australia. currently we are as management doing some due diligence and looking at what those could actually, you know, cost us from a price point of view. And once we're comfortable with the outcome of the due diligence, then we should be able to confirm which acquisitions.
A healthy order book, some comfortable money to spend, a good interim dividend. What more can you ask for from a company? We'll leave it at that, Felicia. Thanks so much for the time and for the insights. Always lovely catching up. We wish you the best of luck for the second half of the year, and we look forward to catching up at the end of the full year. That was Felicia Mseiza, who is the CEO of Raubex Group Limited, joining me to reflect on their first half of the new financial year and the comfortable position they find themselves in.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Alongside the other numbers that we got throughout today was an update from Omnia Holdings Limited about their performance over the 6 months ended September 2024. They started off their first half of the new financial year with a stronger performance. Revenues were up, operating profit was up about 17%, operating margins were up about 12%. The cash position of the business was down slightly, but we're going to get into those details in just a second. I'm joined on the line by the company's CEO, Seelan Gobalsamy, to take a look at the performance and see what we can make of it. Good evening, Seelan. Thanks so much for taking the time. Lovely to catch up with you again. The first half of the year, interesting set of numbers, quite strong and robust performance across the board. Different things, different dynamics that we'll get into in a second. How do you reflect on the new year?
It's great. Good afternoon, Jimmy, and great to talk to you again, and good afternoon to all your listeners. Yeah, I think a very, very strong performance by the group. You know, our revenues are up to 10.9 billion. Our profits are up 17% and a strong cash position. You know, this has been largely driven by our mining business. You know, it shows the diversification of that's been implemented by our strategy execution, diversification between local and international businesses, and then also the diversification between agriculture and mining. So a very pleasing set of results and a strong, strong performance by mining and agriculture SA in the 6 months.
Interesting, Seelan, that you do not mention the other segment of the business, the chemicals segment. The chemicals segment just in general, not for Omnia alone, but chemicals landscape throughout the world has been a very interesting time. And I want to get your thoughts on that around some of the challenges, some of the macro factors around there. You're not the only chemicals producer that's kind of seeing a bit of an interesting time. I mean, your revenues were up on the chemical side of the business about 6%, but some other guys aren't faring as well in the chemical space. What are your thoughts around what's happening in the space at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, you know, let's you know, be clear. Our chemicals business, Protea Chemicals, has not performed well. You know, even though revenue's up, you know, it printed a loss in the first 6 months of the year. You know, if we just talk about chemicals generally, I mean, a number of businesses that were in the same spaces as Protea have either closed down or left South Africa. And, you know, what we're looking for is growth in the manufacturing sector. You know, and if we pause for a minute, you know, what that means is we need labor productivity to go up. We need investment to happen in manufacturing, and we need more products to be manufactured in South Africa and produced in South Africa. And you know, if we look at the manufacturing sector, that has not been happening. So, you know, that has impacted the chemical sector, Protea being one of the businesses there. And the sector has also been hard hit by some of the disruptions we've seen in terms of infrastructure, energy, and logistics. So, you know, what I would like to see is a deeper investment in manufacturing to get going, employment to increase, investment to increase, and the outlook, unfortunately, for that sector is still quite bleak. You know, we're still not seeing that yet. You know, we're seeing some nice positivity around the government of national unity, but we need to all work together to get that to be converted to investment, jobs, and manufacturing on our shores.
Seelan, I wonder if we could take a look at the ESG of the business. This is something you and I have spoken about in the past, and we've looked at it. And it was always the conversation about striking that balance between reducing the carbon emissions, but also increasing the renewable side of the business and the reliance on renewable. And looking at just the performance half year to half year, you're seemingly spot on. CO2 emissions are down, whilst at the exact same time, renewable energy use is up, almost double there. How are you doing that? How are you striking that balance and getting it right?
Yeah, you know, when we think of companies like ourselves and successful, sustainable companies globally, it's very important to have a firm purpose embedded in the business so that our people rally around a common cause. And that purpose for us is innovating to enhance life, and obviously doing that in a sustainable, responsible manner. And, you know, whether it's our plants, our production facilities, our warehouses, our logistics, or whether it's our actual propositions to the farmer or the miner, mines, you know, all of that is underpinned by very, very strong ESG principles. So, you know, we want our farmers to use less water. We want our farmers to use less chemicals. We want our farmers to have enhanced yields at lower risks. Similarly, in the mining side, we want our mines to use to do bigger blasts, to do more complicated blasts, to do cleaner blasts, to have less CO2 emissions, to have better fragmentation so that they use less explosives. So not only do we measure and focus on what we do in our plants, but we also ensure that our propositions, whether that's our agri-tech propositions or our mining tech propositions, are underpinned by sound CO2 principles. One of the things you would have seen is the use of used oil. You know, we in our emulsion, you know, that's the explosives, we use used oil instead of clean oil. And that's better for the environment. It's better for small business because, you know, that oil gets gathered and it gets cleaned and it gets repurposed. And it's also better for the stability of the emulsion and better for the environment. So, you know, what's pretty pleasing for me is, you know, the 4,000 odd people at Omnia all know that we go about doing things safer. And whatever we do is underpinned by very, very strong ESG principles.
And those principles are very evident in the results that they are providing for the business. I mean, if I'm looking at things like water use efficiency, energy use efficiency, those numbers are coming in bang in line with where they should be or even better from the last period. Seelan, there's a tax dispute that's outstanding with the South African Revenue Services. Nobody likes those things. We don't like talking about them. Can you give us some color around what's happening here? Have you guys raised a provision? Is it an amount that warrants concern at this stage?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that's been ongoing for a number of years. It relates to assessments in the 2014-2017 years period, you know, far back. We've been working together with SARS to find an amicable solution, and we continue those discussions. You know, we will do what is right for the fiscus, what is right for the company, and, you know, where we believe, you know, our stance is the right stance, you know, we will stick to our conviction on that, you know. So at this point, we're in a dispute resolution phase, and hopefully that results in the right outcome. You know, if that doesn't, you know, we have got other options available to us, you know, like the courts and others. But, you know, hopefully this matter gets resolved amicably and is put behind us as quickly as possible.
We'll have to leave it at that. Seelan, thanks so much for the time and for the insight. Seelan Gobalsamy, who is the CEO at Omnia, on their update for the first half of the year.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's once again time for Personal Finance. On a Monday, we're going to be taking a look at structured products and structured portfolios and how you can make the most of those. I'm joined on the line by the lead specialist for investment propositions at Standard Bank, Rubani Makoni, to take a look at this and see if we can make sense of it. Rubani, good evening. Thanks so much for taking the time. What are structured products and how do they fit into your investment strategy?
Good evening, and thank you so much for having me. So a structured product or portfolio is basically an investment vehicle that gives clients three things, right? Market-linked exposure, be it to whatever asset class, equities, fixed income, whatever it is. It gives clients predetermined investment returns. So clients can understand what their investment outcome at the end of the investment term will be today. And thirdly, it gives clients a level of capital protection. This could be 100% depending on the structure, or 30% in the case of Liberty's current structured portfolios that are on offer.
What are the downsides to the products? I can imagine with every upside, there must be some sort of downside. What are the risks that come with that kind of guarantee?
Sure. So, I mean, it is an investment vehicle, so not totally risk-free. I think the main thing that would, the main risk I'd probably highlight when it comes to structured products or portfolios would be credit risk, right? Mm. So these type of investments are backed by something we call an issuer, and an issuer is usually an investment bank, such as a Goldman Sachs, BNP Paribas, it could be Standard Bank, APSA, whatever it is. So backed by an issuer. So, I mean, the biggest risk when it comes to structured products or portfolios would be the credit risk. So if the issuer defaults and is unable to deliver on the promised predetermined investment return to clients. There are other risks that exist in the market, such as, you know, low liquidity risk for this type of investment vehicle. But I think credit risk would be the main one I'd highlight when it comes to structures.
That's quite interesting. That takes me back to a company called Credit Suisse, where you kind of, for the most part, think you're safe with the bigger banks, but anything can happen. And that's why you said they are not risk-free, because life is like that. Life is not risk-free. Rubani, let's look at the performance of these products, not necessarily specific performance, but how do they stack up against kind of the traditional things that we know? We know equities, we know bonds, we know futures markets. How do structured products and portfolios differ, if anything, and how do they stack up in terms of just a performance base?
Sure. So I think structured products, depending on what you are, I mean, every structure is different. They generally have been able to perform well. If I compare them, I mean, a structure has the potential for unlimited upside, but very limited downside, I think, which is what their appeal is. If we compare them to more traditional investments, I mean, if for instance, in the case of Liberty, we give clients access to offshore equities, although this is a RAND-based investment, but we give clients access to offshore equities. Performance is good. I mean, our past structures have delivered on their promised return. Did it shoot the lights out and give you 20%? No, it did not. But they do generally perform well and have the potential to give you that unlimited upside with a level of protection.
Mm. Rubani, when we look at products and we look at investments, or you look at your investment strategy, talk to me about how structured products and portfolios can be incorporated into sort of a diversified strategy. I've got a pension plan, I've got an RA, I might have a provident fund. I'm sitting down with my financial advisor and I'm saying, I need a little more diversification from the traditional things here. Is something like a structured portfolio or structured product something I can allocate some money to and benefit from that from a diversification perspective?
No, absolutely, Jimmy. And it really just depends on what your personal financial goal would be, right? So structures are a type of investment that has a particular term. We've got structures for 1 year, 3 years, even 5 years, which is in the case of the Liberty structures. So if it fits, if you don't need the money, if you can afford to lock away the money for whatever the investment term is, absolutely. And because there's so many different types of structured products out there, right? It really depends, again, going back to your financial goal. Are you looking to externalize your money? What kind of markets do you want access to, et cetera? So they definitely do have a place. But again, sitting with your financial advisor, he'd let you know what type of structure makes sense for you.
Speaking of different types of markets, are there specific markets where structured products might perform better as a result of lower risk? I'm thinking about, say, a market like Switzerland, where you kind of have a lower risk of default on some of the products that UBS might offer versus another institutional bank offering the same sort of product on in a different part of the world. Not to say that Switzerland is that example per se, but are there certain areas where you might find that you're better off having your structured product in that area because the conditions are just better?
Interesting question, Jimmy. So what I'd say is may not necessarily be better or worse. Mm. I think what it boils down to would be the credit rating of the issuer backing your structure, right? So we offer structures, we're sitting in South Africa, but we've used international banks. And I think the credit rating of the issuer is what's very important. From our perspective, you know, if it's an international issuer or bank that we are using, they need to have a particular credit rating of A. If it's a South African bank that we're using to back our structures, that credit rating is BB+. So I think it really boils down to the quality and the credit rating of the issuer backing your structure. That will determine, you know, the risk of default, etc.
I suppose this is where those all-important ratings agencies come in around the ratings of those investment products. And when we look at things like products being sub-investment grade, would this have a bearing on the structured products and how the products are put together?
Absolutely. I think the credit rating of whatever issuer is backing the structure is a very important part of the proposition. We obviously want to be, you know, give client structures that do deliver on their promise. So going with highly rated, good quality issuers definitely does help that.
Good structures, a good credit profiles, but structured products could be something you could look at for your portfolio. Remember, please speak to your financial advisor. Do not say that you got financial advice from the SAFM Market Update Show or any of its guests. That's why financial advisors exist. We will leave it at that. Rubani, thanks so much for the time and for the insights. That's Rubani Makoni, who is the lead specialist for investment propositions at Standard Bank, joining me to take a look at structured products and how they could potentially be of benefit to you.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
We've come to the end of the show, folks. If you've missed any of the conversations, you know exactly where to catch up on them. It is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Hose is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news, followed by Michael Abramson and the top sport team. From my side, good night.